shortages of pharmaceuticals, fuel, and electricity. The national currency has also lost 95% of its value. Is Mikati able to form a cabinet at last? And if so, what's the cabinet going to have to do with all the predicaments besetting the country? We'll put those issues and relevant ones in the spotlight. For an update, let's go to Mariam Saleh in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, for an update on the latest there. Mariam, over to you.
Well, of course, the latest is that we had a meeting between Prime Minister-designate Mr. Najib Mikati and President, President Michel Aoun, and the Prime Minister-designate stressed that these meetings will be continuous, perhaps even on a daily basis, in order for there to be a quick formation of the cabinet, which is very necessary at this point. And what we're hearing from today from all the parliamentarians, the members of parliaments, and some of them are also previous ministers and so on, they've lived through so many cabinets, and they are stressing that the situation could not be worse than it is right now in Lebanon, with the situation that you mentioned, the lack of fuel, lack of medicine, and so on and so forth, and the fact that the prices are rising hysterically. So therefore, there needs to be a stop to this economic collapse, as everyone is calling it, the worst since the 1850s, and that is something that is extremely grave and extremely critical. And this is why we see that now there's a push from all the sides to form this cabinet. There seems to be that support, that internal support. At the same time, there is a certain foreign, if we may say, push or also encouragement that you should form the cabinet and we'll give you all the assistance that you need.
Okay, thanks for that. Mariam Saleh, correspondent in Lebanon. We're discussing Lebanon in this edition of The Spotlight. I'm your host, Fahruz Najafi, and joining me will be author and researcher in strategic and political affairs, Ali Hamia, in Beirut. And we'll have Professor of Law and Political Science at NDU University, Eugene Sincenik, also in Beirut. Good to have you both, gentlemen. Welcome to the show. Let's go to Ali. After months of political deadlock, Najib Mikati has been appointed as prime minister. And this as the Lebanese protesters have been demanding someone from outside of the ruling political elite whom they see responsible for bankrupting the country. Is Mikati able to form a government? And if so, could he be considered a savior for Lebanon?
First of all, it's not a coincidence to choose Prime Minister Mikati for this post at this time. Previously, he was chosen also in 2005 as a mediator and a middleman between the 8th and 14th of March parties. And since then, he served as like a heel person to the situation. This one of good points, you know, it can be marked for Mr. Mikati. And then he was appointed in 2011 also as prime minister, since, you know, after the resignation of Prime Minister Hariri. The problem is in Lebanon now, we cannot choose better than Mikati, because maybe I'm talking in the, you know, on behalf of the politician, not the people, because the people has another idea about Mikati and the whole leader in Lebanon. Prime Minister Mikati in 2011 and during his era, let's say, the vessel of death that exploded later on seaport of Beirut was at his time when it was entered. This is our first point of bad images of what we have kind of leaders in Lebanon, and among them is Mr. Mikati. Mm-hmm. The second thing is Mr. Mikati is very involved in corruption in Lebanon, and it's not only my opinion. Mm-hmm. It's like what we can see, like from borrowing from banks, like about $400 million worth of debt with banks. Okay. And but the best of worst now we have, okay, the best of worst that we have in Lebanon is Mr. Mikati.
Okay.
Since we passed through an experience with Prime Minister Hariri, that he was resigned in 2019. Mustafa Adil, after Hassan Diab, Prime Minister Hassan Diab. Most of those people are very afraid to be sanctioned by the United States. That's why it's very hard for them to form a government.
Prime Minister Mikati will face, if you allow me. So let me ask Eugene what he thinks about this, because protesters want somebody outside of what they call the oligarchy, and Mr. Mikati is just there. And he's been, of course, leading the country twice, like you said, as Prime Minister, 2005, 2011. Now, this time around, the situation seems to be much worse. Can he handle this properly this time, Eugene?
Well, that's a good question. If you want to ask about his competencies and whether he's able to do things right and effectively, I would agree with Ali Hamei. He is definitely able to do what he sets out to do. The question is, what is he going to set out to do? If you look at his home district in Tripoli, it's a mess. He and a couple of his cronies have driven this beautiful city into the ground. It has an airport, it has a harbor, it has a train station, it has an oil refinery, and a world-class fairgrounds, which are all in disrepair. This is Mikati's world. So is he going to take his skills in business, in the speculation sector, in construction and in communications, where he and his brother have made literally billions of dollars and served the country? If he chooses to do so, he's our man. He also enjoys, I think, the respect of all sides, including the United States. He was brought forward by Hezbollah. He has the backing of Hariri. So I think he can do it. I think he will set out and achieve whatever those goals are. Now, whether he's going to stand up to the corrupt forces in the country, he could. I mean, the situation is so dire at the moment that I think even the ruling elites are starting to get worried. Look, their children have to go to school and breathe the same air that our children breathe, and eat the same poison food and not get access. We can't, even with the fresh dollars, Lebanon's recent gift to the English language, even with the dollars coming from outside the country, you can't buy the medicines you need, even if you have the dollars. So I hope he sets out to save the country. If he does, he can do it.
Now, Ali, the Lebanese economy has been in a tailspin, horrible situation there. The currency has lost most of its value in a year. So what could Mr. Mikati's priorities be to remedy the situation?
The problem is we have experienced Mr. Mikati and the others. You know what? He was nominated by the former Prime Minister's Council. And this gives us an idea of what Mr. Mikati can do. First of all, it's very heavy situation that he cannot tolerate it. First of all, we can say if he may be accepted by all parties in Lebanon or communities. Second of all, he has to face the economy, the disaster, and currency inflation, and the sea boundaries. And we don't have to forget that the declaration statements of the government. Could he make it? Could they form it? We know that the what we call them 8th of March parties, the golden rules, the golden statements of people, army, and resistance, and how we can that be dealt by him. If he can collect all those problems and solve it, this is one in one hand, but the heaviest load that he can, if he can manage it, this the seaport explosion in Beirut. Mm-hmm. I think what's going on in Lebanon now is just to pass the time in order to bypass the 4th of August, so people will not be on the street against any forming of government. Mr. Mikati, I think it's very heavy load on him. If he can do it, he must be supported by all Lebanese parties, all Lebanese people to do so. But before he was prime minister. Could he do that? He could not do anything. And we were like having so much like funds coming from everywhere. Now we are under 100 billion dollars, you know, in worst economy debt in history of Lebanon.
Right.
I don't think he can manage to do so fast. And beside that, we have also what's coming in a few months, the parliament election. Okay, can he manage to do that? Can he manage to satisfy all parties in Lebanon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question first. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Eugene, Ali mentioned the horrible situation, the dire economic situation there. So what went wrong? What made Lebanon reach this stage? And what reforms are needed?
This might sound counterintuitive, but I would say nothing went wrong, and everything went right. This is what they wanted to do. This is what they set out to do, and they achieved their goals. Lebanon has so many resources inside and outside the country. Mm-hmm. Lebanon is not Bangladesh or Haiti or something. Lebanon is a country, if they want, they can solve their – I've been living here since 22 years, since 1999. We can solve our problems like that if we want to. The problem is, the bad news is, we can solve our problems like that, but we choose not to. Now, Mekati is a very competent man. So I am absolutely convinced he can deal with the issue. This was brought up, the sea border with Israel and the issue of oil and natural gas. This is about, and this is indicative of the problem. This is about good governance. If we decide to have good governance in the oil and gas sector, we can turn this thing around. And the whole issue of foreign relations. Here again, I think he has the ties to the different players in the world if he can pull this off. The restructuring, indicative of this is the port. Are we going to rebuild the port? Or are we going to allow Haifa and the Israelis to take over the Levant and the sea lanes? Mm-hmm. The Beirut port is the key, is the gateway to the Levant. Since for the last 150 years, it was built to connect Beirut to Damascus and the hinterland. Haifa will take over if we don't do anything about it. And these deals that the Gulf states are now making with Israel, that's not going to stop. That's going to get worse. And finally, I would want to bring up the issue of asset recovery. We have, you know, we don't really know how much, but at least $20 billion in assets which were stolen from the banks, including my life savings. Mm-hmm. And we need to go out, just like any West African banana republic, and bring it back. Lebanon is a banana republic in this respect, and the foreign players are allowing them to get away with it.
Right.
I would say
right.
There's complicity on the part of the international players on this issue. So if we can get the assets that are outside the country and bring them back, and the assets that are hidden within the country, mm-hmm. we can solve the country's problems very quickly. And Mekati's our man. If he chooses, he's our man.
Right. Okay, Ali, let's look at France. France has offered this initiative based on which millions of dollars of international aid has been pledged. And the initiative is conditional, of course, on the implementation of some widespread reforms all across different aspects of government. So, but the question is, isn't Paris responsible at least partly for the current mess that Lebanon is grappling with now?
You know what? Every party in Lebanon is related to a foreign country. But we in Lebanon, the most important for Lebanese is France, because we call it the mother of Lebanon, or the motherland of Lebanon, whatever. Since 1991, and we were supported by France, you know, and we get so many we were funded like so many times by Paris, 1, 2, 3 CEDARS and whatsoever. And we didn't have any plan, you know, how we're gonna repay this amounts later on. The problem is, especially France, and since you know Jacques Chirac and then Sarkozy, Holland, and now Macron, they saw what's going on, and they still seeing what's going on, but they let what's going on just to take its long distance, if we may say call it, We get so we have so many corrupted leaders, and they still, and they are no shame. With no shame, they are doing it. They still doing it, and most of the countries now that they are asking for us to reveal, they were involved in our corruptions.
Okay. Now, Eugene, Mikati is supposed to follow on the French initiative. Is that the solution for the Lebanese issues and woes?
The French plan is good. It's a year old. They could have done this at any time. I think that the window of opportunity from January 2020 until the blast last year was an opportunity that was wasted. Civil society is complicit in this mess, in this disaster. Civil society was asleep at the wheel throughout the first half of last year, and they are at fault as well. I would say as far as France is concerned, it's true. Ali Khamenei said this correctly, that we all have ties to France, to Russia, more recently the United States, Iran, Saudi Arabia. This is the normal Lebanese approach, and I think it's also the problem to always call in daddy when we have problems that we can solve ourselves. Mm-hmm. We have the resources in this country, and most importantly, if you want to look at the foreign resources, it's the Lebanese diaspora. We have so many good Lebanese who have left the country, who would love to come back and help build the country. And with COVID-19, we've seen this happening online. So the offline merge online, our OMO world, makes it even easier for us to link up with the diaspora and really introduce the one thing that will save the country, which is rule of law. And that's all we need. We need to respect the rules and apply them, because when Lebanese go abroad, they're really good. The problem is the culture of impunity within this country. And Mikati has a choice. I mean, he can either continue to go along this road and lead us to the ultimate disaster, or he can turn it around. And he can turn it around very easily with the resources we have.
Okay. Ali, let's we'll talk about France now. Let's
are corrupted. I think the system is corrupted. The whole system needs to be changed. Mm-hmm. You know, because most of people, corrupted people in Lebanon, and the corruptions and the misleadings were like under the law, not above the law. So legally, they did all the corruptions in Lebanon.
Okay, Ali, also, I want to ask about the U.S. Where is the U.S. in this?
United States, usually, you know, the most important for the United States in the region is the security of the Zionist entity. And what's the most important for the U.S. is to save the sea boundaries with Lebanon now. Okay, and if we may say and remember that on the 17th and before the 17th of October 2019, some big American politician came to Lebanon and he said, either, you know, we solve the Lebanese boundary or starvation. Lebanon will go into starvation, and that's what we are going through now. They didn't say we would be a poor country. They didn't say that we would be only like corrupted country. They say we would be starved. And that's what we are passing by. We are not allowed to import like oil from Iran or Iraq. We are not allowed to deal with Syria. Of course, we have on the southern boundary, we have our enemy. So we are totally seized by United States. Mm-hmm. And what's, you know, amazed me that some people in Lebanon will accuse the resistance in Lebanon by having people going so down and in need. We can blame only, by my opinion, we can only blame who put us into sanction and seized the country, the whole country, from all around borders, okay, from all sides.
Now, Eugene, isn't it high time that this traditional sectarian consensus system of governance be abolished?
Oh, that's That is the question. First of all, I just want to say, Ali, I agree the system is corrupt, but I would disagree. The system is not corrupt. It is corruption. Corruption is systemic. Corruption is the system. So it's so ingrained in the culture. And the sea borders, I just want to mention that in passing, but I'll get back to that. Corruption is closely linked to sectarianism, not confessionalism. Lebanon is a very diverse country, and each group needs its respective representation. Confessionalism is a good thing. Sectarianism is the abuse of difference. And this is a system that does not have to be. There were many, many periods in Lebanese history where the differences led to coexistence. Mm-hmm. So we can go back to that. There are people who thrive on abusing differences within the country, whether they're language or religion or skin color. We know different countries have different types of diversity. I know that Iran has a very interesting model for diversity, relatively well respected around the world. So I would say that diversity is not the problem. It's the abuse of diversity to cause fights within the groups and to feed on corruption. Just the issue of the sea borders, I think that's actually an issue for hope as well. No matter who you are in Lebanon, you have a certain grudging respect for Hezbollah. What they did in 2006 was amazing. I mean, we all know that. So the Israelis are willing to negotiate because of the resistance and the sea border. They have to. Oil and gas investments, especially gas investments are long term. So they have to, if they're going to go forward with their plans for the Arab Gulf, and that's the American game plan now, it's okay. Israel and the Gulf, they have to have peace of some sort with Lebanon. So I would say the resistance is actually a good thing in our international relations with the U.S.
Okay, unfortunately we're out of time. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Author, researcher in strategic and political affairs, Ali Hamia, joined us from Beirut, and also from Beirut, professor of law and political science with NDU University, Eugene Sen-Senek. I've been your host, Behrouz Nedef.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Worship in Islam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Since the beginning of human history, worship has played a central role in people's lives. Devotion to a higher being continues to tie humanity together, despite differences in customs and a variety of beliefs. We often associate worship with specific religious acts performed to a deity, distinguish it from other facets of one's life. However, the concept of worship in Islam is all-encompassing, and it incorporates ritual worship as well as common daily tasks. In Islam, worship is the very purpose of our existence. God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, declares in the Holy Quran, the Holy Book of Islam, I did not create mankind except to worship me. Muslims worship Allah, the creator and sustainer of the universe, out of love and submission. They believe that he is one God, which is known as Allah in Arabic, who is completely unique and only he deserves to be worshipped. So the philosophy of worship in Islam is not just actions that are done towards a deity, a super being. No, this is not what it's confined to. Worship in Islam has to do with your entire lifestyle, the way you live your life, the way you act, the way you speak, the way you interact with other people. This is all and can be all worship in Islam. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the concept of worship in Islam. And we said that it's not something that is limited to a few actions. Worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a concept that is much broader in its context and in its nature. Worshipping Allah is a comprehensive concept within Islam, along with traditional rituals such as praying, fasting, you know, so on and so forth. It also consists of any lawful action a person does with God consciousness and in the hopes of earning reward from Almighty Allah. Therefore, devoting oneself to God in Islam does not require a person to enter a place of worship, nor embrace monasticism. Rather, fulfilling this purpose of life is an active daily pursuit from the Islamic perspective. Hence, a Muslim can be engaged in worship throughout the day, be it at home, work, or anywhere else. As you can see, worship in Islam is a deeper concept. Let's look at some of the examples that we can think of. So let's say that you are spending time with your family. You are playing with your kids. But your intention is that you are loving your kids and playing with your kids and entertaining your kids for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because Allah wants you and expects from you that you take care of your kids, of your wife, of your family, of oppressed people in the society. You do it out of this sense of responsibility and for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and that same action becomes a worship of Allah. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Eid Ghadir Khum celebrates the divine appointment of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, the cousin and son-in-law of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as Prophet Muhammad's vicegerent and successor. We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Qadir.
The World with Reporters.
Two times Prime Minister Najib Mikati has been given the task of forming a Lebanese cabinet for the third time. After officially being appointed by President Michel Aoun, Mikati stressed that he needs the confidence of the people, not only the lawmakers.
To stop the inferno, we all need to cooperate together. I know this is a difficult task, but I have my mind set. If I didn't have necessary foreign reassurances, I would have not taken this step.
While stressing openness to all factions, Mikati also noted that the new government will be formed, quote, according to the French initiative, for the interest of Lebanon and its economy. 72 members of parliament endorsed Mikati, including Hezbollah's loyalty to the resistance bloc.
Since the resignation of Hassan Diop's government in August 2020, the loyalty to resistance bloc has called for the formation of a government in order to facilitate the country's affairs. We have always dealt very positively with all the efforts, and with the emergence of signs pointing to the possible formation of a government, we have voted for Najib Mikati.
Experts believe the rhetoric with which Mikati has begun his task is that of openness, and therefore could pave the way for more flexible talks with all sides.
Prime Minister Mikati has clearly said he has foreign guarantees, and he also said there are no preconditions from any of the partners in the country. So this is a new method of dealing with things in Lebanon, would entail that all sides deal positively with this formation, since they all want a way out of the crisis in light of a looming security calamity if the crisis persists.
Mikati, who seems to have the support of the United States and France, has claimed he can stop the economic and financial collapse, which has worsened since October 2019. The designation of Najib Mikati as prime minister was calm and prompt. However, what lies ahead will be much more tumultuous, whether it is the formation process or facing the multifaceted crisis in Lebanon. Mariam Saleh from the Presidential Palace in Baabda.
People have been displaced from their homes after Taliban captured the Shia-dominated district of Malestan in central Ghazni province. They say the Taliban committed war crimes by killing tens of civilians.
We were in the region during the first two nights of the Taliban attack, but were forced to leave our homes. The Taliban forced us to provide them with food and drink. They also killed about 40 innocent civilians.
The recent Taliban advances across Afghanistan have brought heavy consequences for local Afghans, especially those who live in remote districts and villages. The Malestan in west of Ghazni province is one among attacked regions by the Taliban over the past weeks.
We call on the government to retake our district and secure the roads connecting Malestan to the province of capital city of Ghazni. We, the people of Malestan, are the part of Afghan nation, and the government is responsible to provide us the security.
Taliban has dismissed any reports on killing of civilians in the Malestan region. Fighting between the Taliban and Afghan government forces has increased over the past months as foreign troops leave the country. The Taliban has made rapid gains, retaking border crossings and rural areas. The government has stepped up operations to push back the militants. Figures show that at least 3,000 people have been displaced from Malestan district over the last 10 days following Taliban attacks there. Displaced residents say government forces did not resist those attacks as they had expected. This, as Afghan officials have repeatedly claimed that troops were tactically retreated from dozens of districts, including Malestan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Israeli warplanes carried out airstrikes early Monday on positions in the Gaza Strip in response to incendiary balloons fired from Gaza. Palestinians say these balloons are a means to pressure the Israeli regime to respond to their demands and lift the siege imposed for 15 years, deteriorating the life of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
Israeli airstrikes are part of efforts by Israel to undermine the Palestinian resilience and increase the suffering of Palestinians. These airstrikes show the weak position of the Israeli army. The Israeli regime is linking the reconstruction in Gaza to political issues, including the fate of its soldiers in Gaza, and we won't accept this. The ongoing blockade and restrictions will lead to serious consequences, and the resistance won't remain silent.
Among the demands, Palestinians call for the import of building materials required for the reconstruction of Gaza and the Qatari grant. Israel refuses all the Palestinian demands and links the reconstruction process in Gaza to political issues.
The Israeli regime has stopped the import of the required construction materials needed for factories that were damaged during the latest escalation. This has led to paralyzing the economy of Gaza. The Israeli Israeli regime thinks these attempts will break their willingness, but Palestinians will always support the resistance as the only means to defend their rights.
According to the Israeli army statement, the airstrike over Gaza won't stop as long as Palestinians keep firing incendiary balloons. Palestinian resistance expressed it's ready for all scenarios, including renewed fighting in the face of the Israeli inhumane acts.
The Israeli airstrikes reveal the true nature of the tension between Israeli regime and the Palestinian factions. There are many issues that need to be resolved, including reconstruction of Gaza. If Israeli regime keeps ignoring the Palestinian demands, we won't sit idle.
Palestinians here say the Israeli airstrike is an attempt to put pressure on resistant groups to give up on their demands. Palestinians also stress they will keep firing incendiary balloons until Israel lifts its crippling blockade and end restrictions imposed on the reconstruction of the war-ravaged Gaza. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Ten months ago, Israeli forces arrested Palestinian football player Jivara Namura and held him behind bars without charge or trial under what's known as administrative detention, deemed illegal based on international law. 3 months later, his pregnant wife gave birth to their first child, a daughter named Julia. This month, his administrative detention order was supposed to end. However, the Israeli regime extended his illegal detention. Almost 2 weeks ago, Jivara started an open-ended hunger strike, protesting his illegal detention and hoping to see and cuddle his seven-month-old Julia. At least 14 other Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails are on hunger strike in protest of their unfair administrative detention without charge or trial. The Prisoners' Affairs Commission revealed that Israeli prison authorities maltreated the hunger-striking detainees and had moved them to solitary confinement to force them in their protest. Israel uses the so-called administrative detention policy to arrest and hold Palestinians without filing formal charges. Tel Aviv insists that they were arrested on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners and their lawyers. Human rights groups say Israel should either prosecute those prisoners or release them, especially that the detention orders can be renewed indefinitely, and the detainees could even stay in prison up to 10 years. Israel holds some 5,000 Palestinians in its jails, including hundreds who are held behind bars without any charge or trial.
For the Palestinian prisoners, the hunger strike is an attempt to expose Israel's illegal policy of administrative detention that must come to an end. Israel, however, continues to be intransigent in dealing with the hunger strikers' legal demands to make sure that no more prisoners would follow the same path in the future. Mona Kandil, West of Occupied Ramallah.
This is exactly what's happening to our whole society today.
This year's International Quds Day Conference was held to coincide with the 7-year anniversary of the 2014 Quds Day massacre. The carnage happened when 35 members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria who are protesting the persecution of Palestinians by the Israeli regime were killed by Nigerian army troops. On 25 July 2014, a street protest was marred by the fatal shooting of dozens of members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, including three biological sons of Sheikh Zazaki.
We are marking the 7-year anniversary of that dark day because it was shocking to us and it was shocking to many Nigerians, whereby three of our leaders' biological sons were gunned down. They were taken to the barracks, to the army barracks. They were tortured to death. Meanwhile, 30 of our members were gunned down.
In a statement, the Nigerian army said the soldiers acted in self-defense, a claim the Islamic movement dismissed as preposterous.
That's nonsense, because they dispatched a contingent of the Nigerian army to go and lie down in a nearby farm, a sugarcane farm, bottle ready, armed, well armed, as if they are going to meet a soldiers of another country, a foreign country. And then if they say they acted in self-defense, where are the guns they recover? They recover from the 33 people they kill. They were just bloodthirsty criminals who are ready to kill the Shiite community.
Jake Zazaki and his supporters were still mourning the 2014 Quds Day massacre when another mass killing took place in Zaria in 2015 at the hands of the Nigerian army, resulting in the deaths of over 340 other members of the movement. Meanwhile, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat have remained in detention in the Kaduna Correctional Center. A Kaduna State High Court judge is expected to issue the final ruling on the Sheikh Zazaki case on Wednesday, July 28, where, according to his lawyers, no case can be made against the Islamic cleric, Anjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Based on a statement released by Afghanistan's Ministry of Interior, to curb violence and limit the Taliban movements, a night curfew has been imposed in 31 provinces across the country, except in Kabul, Panjshir and Nangarhar. This comes as many have argued that imposing a night curfew means that the war is in the own backyard of the residents of cities across the country, a fact that can further spread fear and concern among locals. Many others view this as an indirect call on the locals to take the threats coming from Taliban advances seriously and resolutely stand alongside Afghanistan's National Defense and Security Forces to defeat the Taliban.
The night curfew highlights the government's need for public support in fight against the Taliban. We have to put our weight behind the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces.
Talks between Afghan government and the Taliban have failed to achieve a tangible result so far.
The nighttime curfew will make the things difficult for Taliban. They will be deprived of free maneuvering even behind the entrance gates of some cities. This is because they will be targeted easily by the Afghan armed forces.
Afghan troops have recaptured some areas in a western city which was attacked by the Taliban. The Taliban, who have stepped up their attacks since the withdrawal of the foreign forces, insist that there would not be peace in the country until the removal of President Ghani from power and presence of a new negotiated government in Kabul. In response, the Afghan government argues that the militants need to firstly put their guns on the ground and approve the Afghan constitution as a red line for both the government and people. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Sit back and enjoy the beauty of Iran's ancient culture. In Kushk Art Garden, located in the heart of Tehran, visitors get to learn about Iran's music, literature, painting, and calligraphy, far from the hustle and bustle of modern life. Kushk hosts Iranian artists who create masterpieces that have their roots in thousands of years ago.
Miniature painting has been around in Iran since thousands of years ago. In miniature, we paint flat images with a myriad of details. We avoid adding shades to make it as flat as possible, since in the past, Iranians believed that divine light gives shape to everything.
Metal engraving first stepped into existence 7,000 years ago in Iran. It is the art of incising decorations and metals. In this workshop, I will be available every day for visitors to see how I can turn metals into beautiful handicraft.
Kushk is part of a bigger project dubbed Art Garden. The cultural complex consists of an art lake, poem and literature house, music house, and Kushk Garden, each trying to promote an aspect of Iran's culture. Tehran municipality says it inaugurated the peaceful place, for it says cultural identity has been overshadowed by modern technology.
This precious place was a much-needed initiative to preserve the Iranian art and culture. As time goes by, technology gets more and more intertwined with our daily lives, and our genuine culture slips into oblivion. We need to have such cultural centers that safeguard our cultural heritage.
The Art Garden is situated on Abbasabad Hills in downtown Tehran. In recent years, the area has turned into a tourist attraction that houses structures that combine modern technology with ancient culture, such as large pedestrian overpass called Tabiat Bridge, and the Middle East's largest planetarium, dubbed Mina Dome.
Kushk will be the last piece of Tehran's art garden.
and will be a hotspot for a range of cultural activities, all aiming to revive the ancient Iranian art and culture, which experts believe have become a lost piece in today's hectic life. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
More victims of a malicious Pegasus software hacking scandal have been revealed, as phone numbers of several prominent British Muslim activists have appeared in a leaked list of successful hacks by the Israeli-made spyware. The list includes Raghad Al-Tikriti of the Muslim Association of Britain, Mohammed Kosbar of Finsbury Park Mosque, Baroness Paula Odin, and Anas Al-Tikriti of the Cordoba Foundation. Mr. Al-Tikriti suspects he was hacked by agents from the Emirates over his past criticism of the regime.
I've had a long-standing struggle with the UAE, and simply because over 10 years ago, I highlighted the fact that the UAE had persecuted and followed on by a prosecution of dozens of reformists, of people who called for democracy, who called for accountability, who called for transparency in their own country. It's a scandal. It's a complete scandal, just like all the scandals that engulf us, unfortunately, on every single level. Infringing on someone's entire life. I mean, this Pegasus software, apparently, I'm no technician, but I understand that I'm being told by experts that it basically takes control of your mobile phone, which essentially is, and this is something that humanity needs to contend with, is our entire lives.
At least 400 British citizens have been targeted by foreign regimes using Pegasus. Yet number 10 has remained stunningly silent on the matter.
How on earth could Great Britain, no less, be blasé regarding 400 of its citizens being attacked in such a callous, obscene, despicable manner by a regime that is non-democratic, absolutely, it's anti-democratic, authoritarian, rogue, corrupt regime such as the United Arab Emirates?
The UAE have failed to respond to the accusations, but they are ultimately just one of up to 40 regimes currently using the Pegasus service. The real question for British victims is, did local intelligence services know about the hacking? And if not, how could this failure have possibly been allowed to occur? Robert Carter, London.
U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman visited Seoul this week to meet with her South Korean counterparts to discuss North Korea, China, and other issues. She stressed what she sees as the two states' mutual concerns in remarks also aimed at Beijing.
Our two countries are bound together by our common security interests, by our economic ties, by our common values of democracy and freedom. We will continue to discuss regional challenges, including actions that run counter to the interests of the United States and the Republic of Korea and threaten to undermine the rules-based international orders.
South Korea has tried to balance its relations between China, now its largest trading partner, and the U.S., its security guarantor. And Seoul recognizes it needs the U.S. if it wants progress on peace with North Korea. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman once again voiced Washington's desire to bring North Korea to the negotiating table and its support for inter-Korean engagement, issues of primary importance to South Korean President Moon Jae-in. But Washington's support on those issues may come with strings attached, as the U.S. seeks its Asian allies' backing in its ongoing crisis with China. Joining the U.S. containment strategy against China might be costly for South Korea, say experts. Large demonstrations against the deployment of the American anti-missile defense system, THAAD, erupted when it was deployed in 2017. China then slapped South Korea with heavy economic sanctions over hosting the U.S. missile Shield.
It's a tragic history that powerful countries have used the Korean Peninsula as their battlefield. Preventing that history from repeating itself is most important for South Korea to avoid becoming entangled in a battle between the U.S. and China. They must firmly stake out a neutral position even though it would cause friction with the U.S.
Sherman will next visit Mongolia and then China for just the second high-level meeting between American and Chinese officials since U.S. President Joe Biden took office. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Environment and energy ministers from the group of 20 rich nations have gathered in Italy's southern city of Naples for a two-day summit on environment, energy and climate change. The talks, chaired by Italy, which holds the rotating annual presidency of the G20, have reportedly been inconclusive so far, as officials are struggling to find common ground to put together joint statements on the topics being discussed. On Thursday, Naples saw a number of anti-G20 protests being staged in different parts of the city. In the morning, hundreds of protesters tried to break into the building where the meeting was taking place. Activists from the campaign group Avaaz, wearing masks depicting Argentinian soccer player Diego Armando Maradona, staged a protest calling for debt relief for developing countries.
People are sick and tired of being lied to. Once again, it looks like there will be a complete lack of any commitments and money. The richest countries are telling the poorest countries we need to protect the environment, and the poorest countries are saying we need money for that.
The largest anti-G20 rally was held on Thursday afternoon in the historic center of Naples. Thousands of people from all walks of life shouted slogans against corporate greed and the influence of governments, and in support of a counter G20 summit. Speaking at the G20 ministerial meeting, Italian Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani said everyone wants to be green without making the necessary sacrifices. The minister added that if the financial system won't change in favor of sustainable development, there will be catastrophic consequences for future generations.
The Naples G20 meeting is seen as a key intermediate stage ahead of global climate talks known as COP26, UN Climate Change Conference. The meeting is to be held in Glasgow, UK, in November. Max Civili, Rome.
In the limelight.
The number of COVID-19 cases across the U.S. may have been undercounted by as much as 60%, researchers at the University of Washington have found. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Glenza, reporter. This article is published under the heading COVID cases in U.S. may have been undercounted by 60%, study shows. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The number of COVID-19 cases across the U.S. may have been undercounted as much as 60%, researchers at the University of Washington have found. The study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences builds on research, which has found the number of reported cases represents only a fraction of the estimated total number of infections. It has important implications for how many Americans need to be vaccinated to stop outbreaks. The paper comes as a swath of states across the South and Midwest, especially Arkansas, Missouri, and Louisiana, experience outbreaks driven by Delta variant infections among unvaccinated people. There are all sorts of different data sources we can draw on to understand the COVID-19 pandemic, said Adrian Rafti, a professor of sociology and statistics at the University of Washington and senior author. But he said each source of data has its own flaws that would give a biased picture of what's really going on. What we want to do is to develop a framework that corrects the flaws in multiple data sources and draws on their strength to give us an idea of COVID-19 prevalence in a region, a state, or country as a whole. The study incorporated data on deaths, the number of tests administered each day, and the proportion that come back positive. Importantly, it also incorporated data from studies of people randomly sampled for COVID-19 in Indiana and Ohio. Random sample surveys provide a strong evidence of actual prevalence of a disease because they do not rely on people seeking out tests, which often fail to capture asymptomatic infections. Based on analysis of that data, researchers found as many as 65 million Americans may have been infected. Official tallies put the number at about 33 million. The University of Washington researchers estimated that 60% of all cases were missed, with only one in every 2.3 cases counted in Indiana and Ohio. Recently, the COVID case count maintained by Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and commonly referred by media outlets stood at nearly 34.5 million. Undercounts can depend on the severity of the pandemic and the amount of testing in that state, said Nicholas J. Irons, study co-author and postdoctoral student. He said, if you have a state with severe pandemic but limited testing, the undercount can be very high and you're missing the vast majority of infections that are occurring. Or you could have a situation where testing is widespread and the pandemic is not as severe. There, the undercount rate would be lower. The findings have important implications for the prospect of reaching herd immunity, the point at which outbreaks end because the virus cannot find new hosts. As of May, scientists believe the herd immunity threshold for COVID-19 to be around 80%, a number that has edged upward with the emergence of highly contagious variants such as Delta. By the spring of 2021, the study indicates about 20% of the U.S. population had been infected with COVID-19. Without a mass vaccination campaign, the findings indicate the U.S. would be unlikely to reach herd immunity anytime soon and therefore likely to suffer waves of outbreaks, hospitalizations, and deaths. Even with a mass vaccination campaign, the U.S. is unlikely to reach herd immunity this year or perhaps ever because of highly contagious variants, low vaccine acceptance in some states, and because children under 12 are not eligible for vaccines. About 56% of Americans are fully vaccinated, but those inoculations are not evenly spread. Northeastern states tend to have administered the highest proportion of vaccines, and states in the South and Midwest the lowest. That uneven distribution has allowed an outbreak of Delta infections to sweep through unvaccinated people across Arkansas, Missouri, and Louisiana. Vaccines currently authorized in the U.S. are effective only against one type of variant. Low vaccination rates, including among health workers in the U.S., have in turn sparked a national debate on vaccine mandates, with hospital chains and major city governments beginning to institute mandates for workers to be vaccinated. The American Medical Association issued a joint statement with dozens of doctors and nurses groups calling for mandatory vaccination of health workers. Elder care workers in particular have among the lowest vaccination rates in the medical industry across the United States. More than 40% have yet to receive a shot.
Why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say.